In a war of brother versus brother, theirs has become the most famous broken friendship. Union General Winfield Scott Hancock and Confederate General Louis Armistead. Books like Michael Shera's The Killer Angels and the movie Gettysburg, which was based on the novel, presented a close friendship divided by war. But history reveals something different. Were Generals Hancock and Armistead rightly cast as symbols of a nation torn apart, or merely acquaintances whose lives intersected? Joining us today is Tom McMillan, who's authored the new book, Armistead and Hancock, Behind the Gettysburg Legend of Two Friends at the Turning Point of the Civil War. Tom McMillan, welcome to the program. Why did you want to write about these two generals?
Well, Scott, it's great to be here. First of all, I wanted to tell you, I was listening to your previous guest, and I'm actually at a car dealer where there are very few new cars.
Okay. Well, see, now we have a testimonial from on the spot.
Yes.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, on the spot reporting, but I just thought I'd say, I was to your question. Thanks so much for having me. I was just always fascinated by this story. Like a lot of people, I think, I grew up in Pennsylvania. I went to the battlefield as a kid, and then life got in the way. And decades went by. When the movie Gettysburg came out in 1993, it really grabbed me. I mean, I saw it in a theater in Pittsburgh on a Tuesday night. I drove to Gettysburg three nights later, and I've had the illness ever since. I've been going up there multiple times a year. And, you know, one of the stories that really got me was Armistead and Hancock. But as you're starting to look, you realize this movie is based on a novel. It's historic fiction. There's a foundation there. But it's a novel, and I kept looking to read more about them, and I couldn't find anything. And ultimately, that led, hey, if there's not a book, maybe with all the Gettysburg books that have been written, maybe there's an opportunity to write one here. So that kind of started the research journey to do this.
So let's go back to The Killer Angels and the movie Gettysburg. Armistead is sentimental about his time with Hancock before the war, and wonders out loud to General James Longstreet if Hancock is on the other side. Did those conversations, because there was more than one, did those conversations actually happen?
No. There's no evidence that Armistead and Longstreet had those conversations. And the thing that struck me, before going through the answers, I would talk to some serious students of the battle, and we all get reeled in a little bit popular history. What they knew about this story was from the movie, from those quotes. And so when I found out that they didn't happen, I thought, okay, there's something here. And I understand what Michael Shara was doing as a historic novelist. You know, he's emphasizing his story. He's making that point. But for those of us who take it as actual history, we're fooled a little bit then. So I wanted to dig into what kind of friendship they had. And I found out that they were friends. And I think they were good friends. They served together on the frontier for 16 months. They served together in the Mexican War. But they were apart for a long time. They weren't almost brothers. And that's what the movie and the novel say. These guys were almost brothers. Mm-hmm. They weren't that close. But they were friends. So there's certain similarity to it. And they did have a teary-eyed farewell, I'm convinced, out in California before they went off to war, which is the other thing that really grabs you. That here we have men, all across, you know, many men more than Armistead and Hancock, who served together for a long time in the U.S. Army, and all of a sudden, one day, became enemies and were weirdly leaving and saying goodbye to go off and fight one another. That did happen.
You know, and that is one of the things I did want to talk about, because I think it is so timely today that you describe what we know anyway about Armistead and Hancock's last meeting, and included some other officers as well, mostly who went to fight for the Confederacy, like Henry Heth, for example. But that Armistead, he gave his uniform, his U.S. Army uniform, to Hancock and told him to hold on to it. You know, one of the reasons I say that this is timely today is because you had all these men who served in the U.S. Army for years, took an oath. Many of them fought in the Mexican War for the United States. And they decided that I'm going to give that up and fight for the Confederacy. Where Hancock was completely on the opposite. Now, Hancock was a Pennsylvanian, but still, he was pro-Union all the way through. Maybe describe that a little bit of what these men were thinking when they gave up their army, U.S. Army careers to decide to basically commit treason and fight for the rebels.
In some ways, it's hard for us in the 21st century to understand that, Scott, but I think you go back and you realize how important the state was back then. People couldn't travel. I mean, most people didn't go beyond 35 miles beyond their home. You didn't go on vacation from Pennsylvania down to Florida. Your home area was what you knew. And reading the accounts of those officers who went for the Confederacy, they decided they were going to fight for their home state and their own people. And that's the way they viewed it. Armistead, in a letter that I found, actually his son served with him at Gettysburg. In a letter I found in his son's military records, he wrote a letter explaining why he did what he did. And he said, I left to fight for my own country and for and with my own people.
Did Armistead, was he a slave owner, or was he pro-slavery?
Armistead came from a long line of slaveholders. His family were slaveholders for centuries, I would say. He grew up on a farm where his father had 19 slaves. He owned at least one slave himself briefly, perhaps two. So he definitely, you know, grew up in that environment and believed in the Confederate cause. And the one thing I realized, I had never seen that written before about Armistead. There's very little written about Lewis Armistead. 158 years, only one book, and it's a little 64-page book that Wayne Motz, the Gettysburg Guide, did about 30 years ago. That's it. So part of this was just finding the Lewis Armistead story, and that was one of the things that I had seen that had never been published before.
And it is an interesting story. I mean, you know, when I was talking about that conversation you say didn't happen between Armistead and Longstreet, I was going to say that your description of Armistead does not seem to make him very sentimental. I mean, he had suffered several tragedies, was hardened by them, and his men thought that he was very harsh. So it would be out of character for him to be that sentimental with Longstreet about Hancock.
Absolutely. And he was a hard-nosed soldier. He was a military-by-the-book man, as is. But he had a very tragic personal life. For 5 years in the 1850s, one five-year period, he lost two wives and two of his three children to disease on the frontier. I can't imagine what that would have done to you just for your entire life, but in a five-year period. And certainly, and also, you know, you're serving on the frontier, too. You're away from all your friends. You're out in the middle of nowhere. Certainly, it had to affect him. It made him even more hardened and in some cases, sullen. So the Armistead character that is portrayed in the movie, the actor does a great job because he portrays the Armistead character that was in Killer Angels. But that's not the way he would have been at that time.
Hancock was a Pennsylvanian, as I mentioned. He was very skilled as an engineer, a quartermaster, but he wanted to see combat. He got his chance in Mexico. Tell us about Hancock.
Yeah, he, fascinating guy. I knew a little bit more about Hancock than I did about Armistead, but he grew up in Norristown, went off to West Point when he was 16. Not a great student, but he did, unlike Armistead, who didn't graduate from West Point, Hancock did. He was 18th out of 25 in his class. And then he ended up sent to the frontier, and in 1844 is the first time there's a record of these two guys being together. Hancock was about 21 years old, and Armistead, they were at a place called Fort Towson out in what is now Oklahoma on the frontier, and that's where they met. He was a quartermaster, which surprises a lot of people because you think of Scott Hancock as this great military leader, which he was. Some of his staff members think that the quartermaster duties actually helped him become a good general, and because he understood all aspects of supplying the army. And then he comes east and he's made a general right away in the army, and he moves up the ranks. He's a really good day at Williamsburg in a battle that's not very famous, but that's where George McClellan wrote Hancock was superb today, and that's where he got the name. Nickname Hancock the Superb. He moved up very quickly. He was given a division at Antietam in September of 1862, and he's given command of the Second Corps just about 3 weeks before the Battle of Gettysburg, about June 9th or 10th. So he had not been in Corps command very long before the armies clashed at Gettysburg.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is Tom McMillan. His new book is Armistead and Hancock, Behind the Gettysburg Legend of Two Friends at the Turning Point of the Civil War. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Tom, as I say, I've kind of buried the lead here. Let's go right to the climax of what happened at that climatic scene during Pickett's charge on July 3rd, 1863. Describe what actually happened.
Yeah, the Armistead was in Pickett's charge. He was in a support line. He was in the second line of Pickett's men, which upset him at the start of the attack. He wanted to be up front. That was typical of Armistead. But in a way, it's one of the reasons that he and some of his men got as far as they got to the Stonewall. For listeners who know about Gettysburg, he got to the Stonewall at the angle and crossed. Armistead led about 100 men over that wall where they breached the Union line very briefly, known as the high water mark of the Confederacy. He did make it across. There is a marker in the angle, a very unique marker at Gettysburg, the Lewis Armistead Fell Here mark. They mark where he went down. And there's a big debate, which I get into in the panel, of whether it's accurately placed. And my conclusion was, I don't know if it's accurately placed, because if you read the firsthand accounts of the soldiers who were there, they all describe different things. So I think it's probably pretty close, but some say he was hit right as he crossed the wall. Some said he was hit and he staggered forward, and some said he made it all the way up to the second line of guns where the marker is. He is, he's wounded at least twice, and he goes down, and then he's attended to by some Union soldiers. There are some Masonic legends attaching themselves to Armistead, who was a Mason. It is said that he gave a coded Masonic phrase of distress, which is the son of a widow. And the Union soldiers who were Masons heard this and ran forward and picked him up and helped to carry him to a field hospital. Mm. There are enough accounts that that's probably true, but also, Scott, there's no way the Union Army is going to let a wounded Confederate general just lay there. They're going to get, even just for intelligence purposes, they're going to pick him up. So, that story might be a little dramatized. And then he's approached by a Union staff officer named Henry Bingham, who happens to be from Hancock's staff. And Bingham is a Mason, and Hancock's a Mason, and Armistead's a Mason. And this is why we have the very beautiful friend-to-friend Masonic memorial at the entrance to the cemetery annex in Gettysburg. So there's so many legends attached to this story of these guys. And Hancock is about a couple hundred yards to the south, but he's wounded at about the same time. These guys both fall wounded at about the same time.
So let's go back to Armistead for a moment. Again, in the climax of the film Gettysburg and in The Killer Angels, like one of the first things out of Armistead's mouth after he's wounded is asking about Hancock. There is some debate about what was actually said, but what did Armistead say, or what do you think he said? What did the witnesses say that he said when he was wounded?
Well, all we know is the account. There's only one count that's valid. That's that of Henry Bingham, the Union captain who attended him. In the movie, it's Joshua Chamberlain's brother. They didn't want to introduce him as a character. So for fans who've seen the movie, that wasn't Chamberlain's brother. That was Henry Bingham. And he actually thinks he's going. He thinks he's told it's Longstreet. He's going to help Longstreet, and then he finds out it's Armistead. Armistead, they hear the connection, and they talk. And Armistead describes Hancock as an old and valued friend. He's my old and valued friend. And then Bingham only writes about this twice. The first time 6 years later in a letter to Hancock, who asked about the circumstances of this. And 6 years later, he said he either regrets or repents the injury he has done to you. And that has caused controversy to this day. Was Armistead repenting for joining the Confederacy? That was the Union story. And we don't really know. We only have Bingham's account 6 years later, and he even said he wasn't sure. But from what I know about Lewis Armistead and everything he did up until then, and even some things he said afterwards, he was not recanting. He was wherever you think of him, he was a proud Confederate. So it may have been he was upset about having to finally attack, fight against his former friend. But also in the movie, in that scene, Armistead is told that Hancock is also wounded. That did not happen. Henry Bingham would not have known that at the time. They found that later. So, again, that's not all that far off from history, but it's just some of the things that novelists and movie makers put into the movies that make us believe that it was true. They didn't know that in the chaos of what must have been the angle in Cemetery Ridge, that information momentarily did not pass down the line.
So talk about Hancock and when he was wounded. I mean, this guy was, the way you described, I have to admit that they didn't realize that Hancock was as admired and respected a soldier as he was. I mean, even considered for to be the commander of the Army of the Potomac at one time and one time later. But, I mean, this guy was riding around the battlefield when he was wounded. Talk about how he was wounded.
Yeah, first of all, he was one of those guys, and we all know people like this in our lives, is that even if he didn't have a uniform on, you would have followed him. He just had that commander's bent and that commander's style. He was riding up and down lines as an example to his men. They tried to get him to get down off his horse. He wouldn't do it. He was hit in the inner thigh and was bleeding quite profusely. Some men helped him from the horse. And they, you know, the way they did medicine back then, they were digging for the bullet. Now we leave the bullet in there, but they were digging for it, which had to be painful and certainly wasn't helpful. And they didn't find it. They found a nail. And the first doctor said, "You're not hurt that bad, General. This is what hit you. You were shot with a nail." And it turns out the bullet went through the saddle. It took part of the saddle, pieces of wood and nail into the wound. And Hancock, he never really fully recovered from this wound, but it was a few months later when he was recovering at his home in Norristown. The doctor, they couldn't find the bullet. The doctor actually sat him on a chair the way he would have been sitting on a horse, and he put a probe in there, and that's where he found the bullet. And Hancock, it took him about 6 months to get back to duty. He had a pretty good day at Spotsylvania, but he was never really the same. And so I think, you know, he may have risen to Army Command, the full Army Command, had he not been wounded that day. But he wouldn't leave the field. He made them ready to tie a tourniquet around him. He wouldn't leave the field. He sent messages. He was still in command. But he never really, from a military standpoint, from an athletic standpoint, never really recovered from that injury. He goes on to live 20 more years and run for president. So he was fine physically. It's just as far as being in command and riding a horse and commanding troops in battle, it's a little difficult.
In fact, he was the Democratic nominee for president in 1880, but lost. First time that there were two Union generals, Rutherford B. Hayes, there were two, and Garfield, there were Union generals running for president. I want to get back to Armistead for just a moment. A few years ago, when the Gettysburg Foundation opened the George Spangler farm for, you know, the public, we did a live broadcast from there. That is where Armistead was taken after his wound, which, at first, was not thought to be life-threatening. I said wounds, was not thought to be life-threatening, but he died.
Yeah, the doctor who first examined him was astounded that he died. He said he was hit in the arm and the leg. They may have missed a wound. It's possible that they did. There's a theory that, you know, he may have had a blood clot in his leg that went to his lungs, and they certainly didn't know a lot about germs. They did not think this was a fatal wound when he went there, but he died 2 days later, buried in a shallow grave there, and for a few days, though, and then an enterprising and kind of cold-hearted Gettysburg doctor decided to dig him up, thinking that Armistead's relatives would pay for the body, which, in fact, they would. His cousin from Baltimore wanted the body, who was this. Actually, Armistead's uncle was George Armistead, who defended Fort McHenry when Francis Scott Key wrote the national anthem. And the cousin was George's son, paid for the body to go to Baltimore. So it's buried in a cemetery in Baltimore, Old St. Paul's Cemetery, in a family vault right next to his famous uncle George. George Armistead and Lewis Armistead are buried side by side.
Armistead provided or gave some items to Bingham to give to Hancock. What did he give him?
Those were mostly the things that were on him in the battle. You know, his spurs, his seal, his watch, things he carried into battle. There is something from the movie that on the eve of battle, that Armistead gave Longstreet a package that he wanted to give to Hancock's wife should he not make through the battle. The movie says that was sent after the battle. In fact, Armistead gave those items to Hancock's wife in California in 1861 just as they were leaving. he presented them then. So again, part of the movie, he did give the thing, give those items to Mrs. Hancock, and that was more his personal Bible and some personal papers, things that were more meaningful to him. So she did get those, but the items that Bingham gave to Hancock were things that were on his person, part of his uniform at that point.
So we only have a minute or so left, Tom. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. What about Hancock? And we heard a lot about what Armistead said about Hancock beforehand and was thinking about Hancock when he was wounded. What did Hancock say afterwards when he learned of Armistead's death?
Not much. There's nothing. You can't find any. I'm sure he said some things, but there's nothing in the record other than inquiring of Henry Bingham. What, you know, the circumstances of his wounding. Now, Mrs. Hancock, in her book, she writes a book about Hancock in 1887, and she talks about them talking. She is the person who's most responsible for us knowing that they are friends, and they said they thought that he may have died in the way he wanted, gallantly in front of the Union lines. But Hancock, curiously, there's no record of what he said. And it may have been just because they were on to the next battle. You know, we focused so much on Armistead because that was the end of his life. Hancock, you know, went on to recover. He's back in the Overland Campaign in 1864. He's at Spotsylvania. He stays in the army for the rest of his life. He's military governor of Louisiana. He fights Indians out in Kansas, and he actually is in the presidential nomination process three times. Became the nominee in 1880. So he led a full life after that. And what struck me is that a lot of the Hancock biographies barely mention Armistead. This wasn't that big of an item, according to the biographers, in Hancock's life. And that's another reason why I wanted to dig into it and find out what was really there.
Well, it's an interesting book. The book is Armistead and Hancock, Behind the Gettysburg Legend of Two Friends at the Turning Point of the Civil War. Tom McMillan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, thank you so much. My pleasure.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.